Welcome to the Good Hard Story Podcast, where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the exact same story. I'm Catherine Wolf, and I'm a stroke survivor, a speaker, an author, and co-founder of Hope Heals. Tune in here every week for conversations about wholeheartedly living in a good hard story. Join me in this joyful rebellion to the darkness where we discover the treasures hidden in our hurting. Today, we are so blessed to get to have Amy Julia Becker and the amazing Leah Case with me for this episode of the Good Hard Story Podcast. As you may know from previously hearing Amy Julia on here, she is a brilliant thinker, theologian, disability advocate, and human being, author of many incredible books. An amazing podcast, Love is Stronger Than Fear. Check it out if you have not. And Leah Case is my right-hand woman and a deep blessing in my life. And both of these amazing women are just champions of what the Lord is doing through Hope Heals and my little corner of the world. And it is such a blessing to have both Leah and Amy Julia in my life and on this crazy journey towards eventually home. And it is a gift to get to have this moment with you all.
Thanks for having us on.
Oh,
yeah. Well, so glad to be here with you both.
So I was looking on your Instagram this week, which, by the way, if you haven't checked out Amy Julia's Instagram, it's such a great space. She just has so many amazing thoughts. Shares stories of her family and what the Lord's taught her on her journey. But
I could not agree more. She is one of the very best follows that we have on our Instagram. I would highly recommend you follow Amy Julia. She is prolific in content. Don't know how you have the brain space, all the things, energy. I mean, you're amazing.
You are.
But I will check an Instagram from you and be thinking about it all day.
Yeah.
Hmm.
So this past week, you shared a story about Taylor Swift, which I'm incredibly jealous that you went to her concert. And I would love for you to just share with the listeners about that experience with your family and just share what you shared on Instagram.
So I'll start by saying, first of all, thank you so much for just welcoming me here. And what I'm thinking about is any listener who might have heard Catherine's introduction of me in the last podcast and heard that I am a reader and a thinker and someone who really likes books. And so you might have an impression of me as someone who wouldn't be particularly excited to go to a Taylor Swift concert. And you would be right. That would be correct. I am someone who never wanted to ever go to a Taylor Swift concert. Now, the rest of my family firmly disagrees with me on this. So, I am alone. I don't like large events. I don't like going to baseball games. I don't like football games. I don't like really any large events. And yet, the rest of my family deeply wanted to go see Taylor Swift. So, our son got two of the relatively reasonably priced tickets through the Ticketmaster verified fan thing. And they were in what we would call the nosebleed section of the Gillette Stadium in Foxborough, Massachusetts. But his dad, who is the Swiftie of the two of us, was going to take him and couldn't because our son was going to be running in a track meet until the late in the afternoon on the day of the concert. And my husband was going to be speaking at a memorial service 3 hours away from that. So all of a sudden, I need to be the person accompanying my son to the Taylor Swift concert, which not only do I not want to do, it seems really unjust to the rest of the family that mom gets to go to this thing.
Who doesn't care at all about Taylor.
Right, who doesn't care at all. And who has no interest in staying up after 9 o'clock and who does not like putting on any sort of pink costumes and who, all the things. So then Peter and I decide, you know what, we are going to rescind our Christmas gift to our children, and we're going to go ahead and buy 3 more tickets to this concert. So he could drive from the memorial service with the girls. I could go pick up William at the track meet, and we could all be there. But of course, we couldn't all sit together because we're buying 3 tickets after we've already had the first 2. So right. I was a little stressed out about that. And there were a couple other things. It looked like it was going to rain. That was also stressing me out. Then we buy these three tickets for far more money than I would ever admit publicly. And we get an email and we are sent tickets for the wrong night. We have purchased three tickets for Saturday. We are sent three tickets for Friday.
Oh, no.
So I spent 4 days like emailing and chatting online with SeatGeek, getting nowhere. Finally, on the last day, like the day before the concert, Peter finds an email on LinkedIn and gets in touch with someone like higher up at SeatGeek and is like, okay, they're going to replace our tickets. Like the tickets we bought are gone. They were Friday night tickets. We bought Saturday night tickets. They're gone. So we get three tickets, but they're on the floor of the stadium, which sounds amazing, except for the fact that now we have two tickets in the nosebleed, three on the floor. How do you do that within a family? And you can't move between the two because the floor is like this, you know, kind of sacred space, so to speak. So, and it is going, and it's going to be torrentially pouring this whole time. So we haven't mentioned yet, my daughter Penny, who's 17, has Down syndrome. So Penny also is 4'5" tall. And it's unclear whether being on the floor when you're that small is actually an advantage, because are you going to be able to see anything in the, because it's not raised in any way. Right. So all of this is literally keeping me up at night. I will not belabor the story about my own anxiety, but that was this whole other piece to the Taylor Swift concert.
Right.
So we finally all get there late on Saturday night. Like the concert, you know, the opening act start at 6:30. We get there around 7. Penny and Peter still aren't there. They're still driving. And I decided that I would just go and find out whether we could go check out the floor situation to see if Penny could sit there. So I find an events manager named Connor and I talk with him and I just explained the situation. And he said, you know, why don't I plan on, I'll get you all into the floor and we can just see whether she can sit there. And if she's more comfortable in those higher up seats, that's totally fine. You'll keep those tickets. And I said, great. And then Connor said, you know, what I'd really like to do for you though, it seems like you all being together as a family would be really good. And I'd like to see if the ADA seating is available. I know that ADA stands for Americans with Disabilities Act. I don't know what ADA seating is. I've never heard about this. I've kind of been in like disability spaces for a while now. Don't know what he's talking about, but I was kind of like, okay, us being together as a family sounds, I mean, amazing. I literally started crying to me. And the thought that I don't need to make a choice, be separated from my kids, try to figure out whether Penny can handle the floor or not, all of that. That sounds amazing. So Connor walks us in. The concert is starting within like 10 minutes. Taylor Swift is going to be coming on stage. And he says, just hold on. So he goes, talks to some people, et cetera, et cetera. And then escorts our entire family up a ramp to a platform that is probably raised about 4 feet off of the ground at the back of the floor. And he says, there's space for your entire family. The ADA seating is designed for people who are using wheelchairs and walkers. As it happens that night, there's also a group of people who are deaf with sign language interpreters who are also that platform. So our family all together gets what amount to essentially the best seats in the house. They are seats that no money can buy. They are seats that we never could have predicted or manipulated our way into. And they're not even seats that we deserve. I looked up the Americans with Disabilities Act later. These seats are not for people with intellectual disabilities. But Connor saw that our family had a need because we had this child with Down syndrome who's very small and who might get overwhelmed in the midst of a crowd. And he said, if there's space, I want to give it to you. And he did. And so there we were for the next 3.5 hours, rocking out to Taylor Swift with me in a pink cowgirl hat, which, you know, is not, again, my profile. and we had the best time. And it was just the sweetest gift because there we were at like the epicenter of American like materialism, entertainment, consumerism, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was so deeply beautiful. And it was such this little window into the abundance of God's grace and blessing, including one of the things I learned right after the concert was that in the Bible, because it was written to this like dry, arid population, rain was always seen as a blessing. Like the next day I listened to a sermon about this, about how rain was always seen as just this abundance of blessing. And that night at that Taylor Swift concert, she called it the rainiest rain show ever. I mean, we were in the rainiest rain of all time. Yeah. And it really felt to me like just this tremendous gift and blessing, because we were seated among, not just because we got to see Taylor Swift where we did and have great seats, but also because we were seated among the group of people who so often get overlooked and seen as needy or undesirable. And instead it was like, we are getting more beauty, more grace, more blessing because we're here together.
That's so amazing.
It's very beautiful and powerful. And the fact that Penny has an intellectual disability, but was in the section for those of us who use wheelchairs, was just this powerful connect, because Penny, I mean, I'm so glad she could see where you were seated. And it just touches my heart very deeply that, y'all got the best seats because of Penny, you know, like that's the reason that you're the front of the line. It's truly actually very strangely different, but similar to my own experience. On my 30th birthday, we were in Italy, and it was Palm Sunday, and my husband and I got ourselves to church at the Vatican.
Almost like Taylor Swift.
Exactly. Almost. Very, very similar to Taylor Swift. And I'll spare you the whole story, but basically through non-speakers of the same language, we kept getting taken to the front. We're thinking we'll be seated in the way, 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 way back. We end up on the front row of the stunningly beautiful Palm Sunday service. The Pope is making eye contact with us. We are that close. We are the front row. And through many tears, we look to our left and right. And I think I was starting to cross over with my guilt of not being more impaired at this point, because it was just over 4 years. And as I looked around, I would previously have felt totally unworthy to be among the crowd of people with profound disabilities who I felt like they deserve this spot. I don't. But I think the Lord was beginning to show me, but you get to hold a banner here and you belong here. And Jake and I wept as we recognized that because I was a wheelchair user, we were brought to the front seat and with people of very profound disabilities. We were truly the last becoming first. And it was, it was a upside down kingdom moment for me as well, of recognizing not in spite of, but because of the disabilities, we are here. And it was glorious.
I love that story too, Catherine. And I'm so interested in, I think we have a shared experience in that sense of like, I don't want to in any way capitalize on disability. I don't want to pretend that my experience is the same as other people who, at least from my vantage point, have had harder situations or who have not, you know, ended up in the same place. And yet I also have felt really compelled by identifying with people who have disabilities because of that sense of, it's actually this strange sense of understanding how undeserved the grace and blessing is, even though I would say every person with a disability deserves to be in that place of being uplifted. But I think it's almost like that the way our world works is like you pay for your tickets. You get the tickets you pay for. Like you earn it or you don't. And you're either in or you're out. You buy it or you don't. And there's something about the way, a different way of being in the world where there's like an abundance of possibility that includes even the things you never could pay for or you never could earn, and that you don't deserve in the sense of having worked really hard to achieve this goal. you only deserve in the sense of God wanting to love you. And anyway, that's what I hear in your story. And that's certainly what we experienced that day. And it was a reminder to me, certainly, of that sense of wanting to like elevate and honor the people who are seen as like the last and the least. And yet also wanting everyone to understand that the reason God elevates and honors us is out of that place of belovedness, not out of that place of like earning our keep.
Right. Oh, I so resonate with that. I spoke recently at a big conference in New Jersey, actually. And afterwards, I spoke briefly with a man who had recently been widowed. And I handed him a Hope Heals book. And, you know, we both were teary, and he just was very effusive that the presentation had meant so much to him. And I said something I'd never articulated before, but I realized it was so kind of this beautiful journey I've been on with the Lord. I told him, I said, you know, some years ago, I would have felt so much shame to come up to you, to put a book with my husband and I on the cover in your hands, and to, I would be ashamed to look you in the eye because your wife did die. And I felt so much, I have felt so much survivor's guilt. And I almost would feel like I need to not let you see that I lived, my marriage is intact, that these specifics are in my story. And I said, but you know what? The Lord allowed me to recognize, oh, no, no, you're here for this dude. You're here to tell him he is not alone in deep pain. And you're here to put that book in his hands and say, there is hope, even in your broken story. And it's like somehow the Lord flipped that switch that survivor's guilt no more. Instead, you get to be a light and a hope, and you're suffering as well. And you get to show him how to point to Jesus in your suffering. And don't put yourself in a different category. Like don't do that. People are just glad to grow and learn together how to do this life when our expectations are crushed.
Mm-hmm. And I think you talk about that often of like, my pain's not hard enough, or people will come up to you and feel like ashamed to share their pain or their story because it's not as hard as yours, or you felt that with that man. Amy, right. Julia, I'm sure you've been in those similar situations where like, well, I shouldn't share my pain because it's not as hard or not as bad when it's like,
it's embarrassing.
Right. When really our pain shapes our stories, and God has given us this part of our story for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting because I do think there's both, I agree, I have felt what you're feeling. I've also felt, and Catherine, I'm curious whether you felt this, kind of the dangers of the opposite direction too, though, of like false equivalence. So for example, I've talked here before about how friendship has been hard for Penny. And I do think that is directly related to her disability. Yeah. And it's really painful for me, and it's really painful for her. And I do have friends who often will say, oh, friendship is hard for every teenager. And that feels like a real way to shut down the pain of our situation. Mm-hmm. And so it's like it can kind of go both ways where
for sure. You can, oh gosh,
there are like ways of comparison cutting off the experience of pain when it's a false equivalence. But then there's also a way of that we can compare ourselves and say, ooh, it's not as bad as yours, so I'm going to walk away. But I guess in both cases, what we're really wanting is, if there is a comparison being made, that it's being made in a way that can connect us to each other, even in the midst of not the same suffering, but some measure of suffering, some measure of hope, some measure of joy. But I just, I think, yeah, I just want to be careful about the times when comparison pushes me away from people because I think, ooh, my situation's not as bad as yours, so I'm going to walk away. Or I'm going to pretend like my situation's the same as yours when it's really not, because that pushes me away too. But if I can find a space that's like honest but connected, that again, I think is a part of creating those spaces of belonging where it's not spaces of being the same, right? It's spaces of actually belonging here together as we are.
Oh, totally. It's extremely difficult to live well in that tension. For me, I tend to, at this point, over universalize probably, like really kind of make it like we're all in this together. We're all dealing with different pain. We've all got invisible wheelchairs. And I love that that's where I've landed, but I'm very aware, but that can be painful to an actual wheelchair user because it is still different. They still can't easily walk through the door to get to the table. They have a seat at the table, but they need help getting there. And that must also be acknowledged is, yes, there are deep invisible wheelchairs, but they have an easier time in life in some ways. Mm-hmm. And that's very difficult to hold that tension well. And I'm just praying I am as you are. And you know what? Maybe the beginning of getting that right is recognizing it's a thing and thinking through it and processing. How do we hold that tension well? And how do we recognize humanity is groaning and we have hard stories, and yet there is perspective and there is pain and it is complicated. And I think it's cool that we're thinking through it.
Yeah. In To Be Made Well, you talk about creating spaces of belonging. And I feel like this leads into that really well. And honestly, the Taylor Swift and Vatican story are like very physical examples for both of you guys. Like, you know, you were saying Penny didn't really belong in that section, but they created a space for her to belong. Like, what a rich gift for your family. And same thing with the Vatican. You didn't feel like it was your space, but you did belong there. Can you just talk a little bit about creating spaces of belonging and the metric to know what is happening, if that's happening in the spaces that you're in?
Yeah. So I started thinking about this a while ago, both when it came to disability and also when it came to institutional spaces, thinking about like churches and schools, especially spaces that have been built for particular bodies. So whether that is a school that has historically only had white men in the, you know, seats in the classroom. Well, how do you create a, this, use the same space to create a space of belonging if that's been the case? Similarly, within churches, you know, again, if you have a space where you say, we want people with disabilities to know that they are welcome and that they belong here, and yet you don't have a way for someone using a wheelchair to come in the sanctuary door, and honestly, in the front door, then there is a communication that's happening through your space, right? I remember a friend of mine, Bill Gaventa, who did a lot of work in disability spaces, talking about when you build the ramp next to the dumpster in the back of the building, what does that communicate about who you want at the front of your sanctuary? You know, so just the way we communicate through our architecture and through the people who are held up, whether that's literally like portraits on the wall, names of people that, you know, benches are in honor of or rooms are in honor of. And certainly the people who are up front in an institutional space, all of those can really communicate a sense of welcome and belonging to a wide array of people or a sense of, I'm not sure I belong here. I'll give one other example. I remember when Penny was about a year old, I went away on a retreat to a monastery with a group of other people who were in seminary at the time. And there was a brother at the monastery who was asked to read the scripture before our dinner meal began. And he got there and you could tell from the way he walked that he was a little unsteady on his feet and had a strange gait, or an unusual gait, I should say. And he started just flipping through the pages of the Bible, but back and forth, back and forth. So there was kind of a long, somewhat awkward silence as he was looking for the scripture he was going to read until another brother walked over and turned him to it. And it was Genesis 1, which is to say, with for people with familiarity with the Bible, it kind of should have been an easy passage to find. And then when he spoke without real clarity. There was a sense of his words being, you know, he had some sort of speech impediment. And Penny was about a year old. And for me in that space, no one would have looked at me and thought, this is someone who needs to know that people with intellectual disabilities are welcome here. And yet what happened when that man read Genesis 1 as a blessing over our meal that day, it was profoundly moving to me. and profoundly welcoming to me because it was very clear that my daughter would be welcome in this space. Mm-hmm. And no one there would even know that. And so it just spoke to me again of that sense of giving people, and even the person who quote unquote can't read the Bible as well, he read the Bible beautifully as far as I was concerned, and was able to welcome us in a different way. So I think creating spaces of belonging begins with a posture of the heart, but it gets played out in thinking about the ways in which our architecture, our programs, and our people are communicating that sense of welcome. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I'll say on this, I mean, we could talk for a long time, but the last thing I will say right now is that I think there are times when we have to find almost intermediary spaces. So if you're in a church or a school or some other institutional setting where historically there have not been very many people, whether that's with disabilities or of a different gender or from a different racial background or et cetera, your space might not be a safe place for people. Mm-hmm. They might not want to come in. Mm-hmm. And so looking for what I would call like neutral spaces to do collaborative work. So something like Habitat for Humanity, if two churches that have not historically been together could go and work on a Habitat House together, that creates a collaborative space where friendship and relationship can begin. And I think that can be a building block towards a welcoming space within one or both of those church buildings. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I could say more on any of that, but those are some of my thoughts about not just what it feels like to be in a space of belonging, but also how we really identify and work towards creating those spaces.
Mm. Yeah.
Beautiful.
It's so true. And I feel like Mend is a good example of that too, of just, you know, let's create a space that truly everyone belongs in, not just the table in the corner for the wheelchair, but anyone of any ability can come in and enjoy this space, and it's for you.
It has been so telling, Amy Julia, to live life in a wheelchair these past 15 years and be taken up a weird elevator in the back by the kitchen to the second floor of the restaurant to go through another kitchen by the dumpster. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, for me, I've started purposefully staying in the wheelchair and not standing up from it, even though I can get out of mine, because in solidarity with my brothers and sisters who cannot, I'm infuriated. So I'm like, no, you're going to need to figure out how to get me to the second floor. This is ludicrous. And yes, I could pop out of my wheelchair, but I'm not going to. You're going to need to figure it out, because fill in the blank cannot get up to the second floor. And that is not okay.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah, that you do that. I mean, that just seems really important. And I do think I just want to highlight for a minute, having told our Vatican and Taylor Swift story, which is such this like, oh my gosh, we got the best seats. That is not the lived experience day to day for people with disabilities. And that's part of what makes those stories so remarkable. So I just want to underscore that, like, often the person in the wheelchair is not given the seat of honor, but is actually seated next to the dumpster. And that is what I think God is grieved by, and what we all, and what you're talking about, like actually physically using your body to protest that in a subtle but very real and meaningful way is really important.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. I feel called to be a bit subversive in many ways. And what is so beautiful is I can be. You know, I spoke at a church a couple of years ago, and they said, oh, we're so sorry. Or, you know, our church is very old, and we'll need to like pre-plant your wheelchair on stage and walk you up to it if you really want to sit in it during your presentation. And I was like, nope, you're going to need to build a ramp is the reality. And I can't believe it, but they did. They built a ramp to get me onto the stage. And I just remember reading that email and getting chills. Like, wait, are you serious? You're going to do that? It was that easy? So I'm like, the power of the ask is significant. And I'm going to like, yeah, bust down the, well, I don't know the word exactly. I'm going to like pound it out to make churches become more accessible, because it's not that hard and not that expensive and ridiculous. I don't know. It's like there's such a disconnect when 20% of the population lives with a disability. I mean, this is not some tiny niche group. Churches and all spaces need to investigate how to be better about providing accessible spacing to them. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. Jay and I have been known to share a story where these place and specifics will remain anonymous, but where I spoke at a big Christian conference, and all of the beautiful able-bodied alpha females went to happy hour after, and it was on the second floor of this big restaurant, and it was very intimidating already to be there, but the two guests in wheelchairs, myself and another friend and their spouses, were forced to take, I won't even describe, like this, what's an elevator called when it's like a service elevator, to go in a back way. I mean, it was just so humiliating, and like come out and like try to be normal when it's like, we just kind of experienced some trauma. It took 10 minutes to get here, and all these like beautiful, perfect, like spokesmodels are hanging out and we're not in the club. And it was just really very sad, even for someone who has fairly thick skin and isn't easily like, I don't know the word, like feeling insecure. I felt just humiliated.
Right.
And I can't imagine what that feels like all the time, constantly feel that way, as most do. You know, Dr. Kurt Thompson, who I know you also love, Amy Julia, says that babies come into this world looking for someone who's looking for them. And the experience of so many of our friends with physical disabilities is they feel like nobody's looking for them. Nobody's looking out for them. And it's deeply painful. And I think, as you do, as we do at Hope Heals, want to spend our lives making people feel seen and welcome and belonging. And I just see so clearly that you are helping us create such beautiful spaces for communal healing and social healing as well. I would love to hear just a moment of you sharing about this beautiful communal healing that you share about so beautifully in your book, To Be Made Well. And I'm so struck that I pray that is what we can do with the sacred spaces that we are called to build, is make them spaces of true healing in communal contexts.
Yeah, so I do think To Be Made Well is the book I wrote about healing in a broad sense, that from the Bible, and seeing healing as more than physical transformation, seeing that as both individual in the sense of mind, body, and spirit, but also very much connected to community. And we see in like story after story in the Gospels that Jesus is not simply restoring people to their mind, body, spirit, but to their community. So we see often, you know, go tell the priests that you are clean so that you can be received back into your worshiping community, or proclaiming, in the case of some people, he says, don't tell anybody I healed you. But in other cases, he will publicly say, this person has been made well, which is a way of saying, take her back. Take her back into society. And there's a communal healing that's happening not only for that person, but for the society that lost or excluded him or her on the first level. And I think there are there's a pattern or a sense of movements of healing that are available to us both individually and communally. And the way I think about that is honesty, humility, and hope. And so the honesty piece is just paying attention to pain. And we can obviously do that, you know, in our own bodies to ask why something is hurting, but we can do that in our own communities as well. And so that might be paying attention to the pain of the person who's getting off the service elevator and coming late to the party. It might be paying attention to the pain of brothers and sisters who are crying out against injustice in the streets of our nation. It might be paying attention to pain by noticing the people who are not at church on Sunday, right? By noticing the absence and wondering why. But when we pay attention to pain, we begin to be honest about the state of things in a broken world. And then humility is recognizing that we need help if we are going to be participating in healing work in this world. And that help comes both from God, but also from one another. So certainly there's like a prayer aspect to humility and a prayer aspect to any communal healing that we're going to receive. But I think that often happens best in community. That if we, for example, want to have a church that is more welcoming and creating more of a space of belonging for people with disabilities, well, actually having a group of people that includes those with disabilities and those without visible disabilities coming together and praying for what might happen in this space and admitting our own neediness and not knowing what to do and how to change things, there's power in that place of humility and of coming together and asking those things. And then thirdly, there's a posture of hope that leads us towards action, right? We've talked before about hope kind of pulling the future into the present, pulling the promise into the pain. And we can see that whether it's, I mean, I think your picture of saying, oh no, there's going to need to be a ramp if you want me on that stage. Like that is such a picture of hope and of communal healing because your singular action on that one day told that church, we can have people in wheelchairs on this stage anytime we want. And anyone who's using a wheelchair is welcome here and not just welcome in the pews, but like, or the seats, whatever was going on in that sanctuary, but like up here, up front, they can now read scripture. They can now, you know, be a part of the band or the choir or whatever. So there are these very, I think, pragmatic, hopeful steps that we can take, whether that has to do with architecture or programs and institutional change that is also a part of communal healing. But when I think about both personal or communal healing, I tend to think about honesty, humility, and then steps towards hope as the way in which we can together participate in the healing work that God wants to do.
I just love how you think and process and cling to Jesus and wanting to understand what healing looks like, what healing means. And I'm so curious, as you think through and process communal healing and social healing and personal healing, how do you think they are related to each other?
So when I did this kind of deep dive into the Gospels and looked at like every healing story, I saw some patterns. And one of the things I saw was that healing begets healing. So Jesus never, I mean, I might be making this up, but I don't think there's like an individual healing story in the sense that it always leads to more. So whether that's one person gets healed and then they tell other people, I mean, there's a passage in Mark that says people ran to Jesus with their friends on mats in order for him to heal. There's another passage where it essentially implies that he stayed up all night healing people. But then what happens is those people bring that healing into their communities. And that doesn't mean they necessarily go with their own miraculous power to heal, but it does bring that they it does mean that they bring their restored bodies, minds, and spirits back into families and communities. One way to think about this is when we think about like ecosystems, that when, you know, you see in an ecosystem that one piece of the system has is being killed for some reason, there's like this ripple effect of death. But if that one piece is restored, there can also be this ripple effect of life. And I think we see that in family systems. We see that in, we here in our town, I live in a teeny little town, and there was a garage, like a, you know, auto mechanics garage that was left to become gravel and just was an eyesore right in the corner of town. And somebody had a vision of turning it into a park. And you're literally looking at like old glass, concrete, and gravel. And you're thinking, this should just be torn down. Like there's, and instead they reclaimed the building and they put paint on it and they made it into an art gallery. And then out front, they started a farmer's market. And over time, it has become this like hub of community. Hmm. So this literal physical space was kind of healed and restored from gravel to abundant life. And not only did it create something beautiful, but it actually is a place where people want to gather. And you can only imagine just the relationships and the goodness and the beauty that comes simply from creating a beautiful space for people to come together. So I do think healing begets healing, and we can't always know how that's going to happen. But as we bring healing into our own lives, that does extend outward in our ability to offer that to others, but also in the restoration that happens, not just personally, but communally.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you along those lines, what is our role in social healing and what is God's role?
Well, I mean, it's not as though there's some formula for answering right. that question. Mm-hmm. It's a great question.
But I'd just like to know what's in your head and heart, Amy.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Well, thank you so much. I do think our role is to take the next step. And so that is going to require some discernment. It almost always is going to require some partnership. It's going to require some humility in terms of saying, I need help. I'll tell one story. This actually is in my book, White Picket Fences. But I grew up in this town in North Carolina where it was 5,000 people, 2,500 white, 2,500 black. And there were definitely social divisions that had a long history, as anyone who comes from the Southern United States is, you know, well aware. Oh, not to say that there's not a long history of division in the Northern United States as well, but and in that town, there was a woman who I grew up with. So she's in her 70s now. There also were white churches and black churches in this town. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, was a faithful member of a white church. And the church secretary was black. And her grandson was killed accidentally in a shooting. And my mom's friend, whose name is Missy, was really, really upset because she knew this child. And she just was beside herself that there was violence that would have taken his life in her little town. And so she was out on the playground one day with her grandchild, and there was a younger woman, black woman, next to her pushing her child on the swing. And they got to talking, and Missy knew that this other woman, whose name was Tanya, would know the young man who died. And so she started talking to Tanya about this young man. And as she was there, she said, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do?" And she said the next day she got a letter put in her mailbox from Tanya, and that said, "You want to know what to do?" And it gave her three things that she could do to respond to the violence that was in their town, especially knowing that she was a white woman who had prominence. Her family had been there for many generations. She had money. She had relative power. She was a Christian woman. All of those things. And Missy said, "You know, at that point, I realized I didn't actually want to know what to do. I wanted to fret about the problem because it was going to cost me something to actually do what I was asked to do here." And she said, "So I put that note in the bottom of a drawer and I closed the drawer." And she said, "But, you know, the Holy Spirit did that work. And a couple weeks later, I pulled out the letter and the letter said, 'Call the chief of police.' That was the first thing to do." And so Missy called the chief of police and told him the situation. And he said, "Great. Mothers Against Violence in Our Community, you're in charge." And she was like, "I am not an activist. I don't want to be in charge of anything." Long story short, over time, she and Tanya became friends and they began a multi-pronged effort within their town. And Missy was in charge of the prayer part of that. And what that meant was that a group of black and white Christians gathered monthly, not within a church space, again, going back to those more neutral kind of collaborative spaces, but they gathered in different places around their town to pray for peace in their city and to pray against violence. And that what also happened as they prayed together was that they began to build relationships. And so that began to lead to conversations about the schools and about people who are coming into town out of prisons and about work and about all of these other things. So on some level, that began with prayer, but it also began with just taking the next step, right? Like just doing the next thing and looking for the way that the spirit would be connecting them.
Yeah. That's powerful and very convicting that it's not that hard. We really complicate things. I remember reading that story in White Picket Fences, Amy Julia, and similarly feeling like, oh, wait, I have a lot of access. I have a lot of power. There's a lot I could do in a lot of realms to speak into it. And I think I might be getting a nudge that the Holy Spirit's putting a little checklist in my mailbox of things I can do for certain groups. And maybe that's how we all need to live.
Okay. Well, the other thing I was going to say is I think we also can think about healing on like, we can think about our role individually, like just for ourselves, because we do have a role in actually taking care of ourselves and receiving the healing that God wants to do in our own lives. And then in our areas of influence, which I think is in taking that step of whether it's, again, you saying you got to build the ramp or, Missy saying, I'm going to call the chief of police, like this little area of influence. And then there's like an institutional level, which is always going to require connecting with a lot of other people if there's any change or healing that's going to happen. But we all do have some measure of like action available to us individually, influentially, and institutionally. And we don't need to worry about the power that's not available to us. Right. That's not ours to do. So yep. I think that sense of like, it is small steps. It's not actually big things that feel like, oh my gosh, there's no way I could ever do that. It's actually really small things that we can do that still often we want to put in the bottom of the desk drawer and just go about our typical lives. But I think you're right. The Holy Spirit can put notes in our mailbox and often taking that first step is really available to us, even if we're scared to do it.
I think what has really stood out to me in the last few minutes of this conversation too, is just like the deep need for community as believers. And the next right step might be creating a community or seeking to find a community. And it's just those little things. And I know that can be so hard in places of isolation, brokenness, disability, maybe a minority living in an area with a different majority. But as believers, like I have seen such deep life transformation happen in myself and people in our church just from living in community together. And that's where the little steps can start. It's like those two women connected over something because of community and what change then happened because they were in relationship with each other. And referencing Penny as well, friendship is life-changing for her. So community for her is life-changing. Yeah. And what does that look like as believers to take that next step to create a place of belonging, to create community, to help shift this social healing in others?
That's a beautiful word. I feel like we should wrap up. Is that right?
I think so.
Amy Julia, as always, you are just a brilliant theologian, and we are honored to be on the journey with you, seeking true healing and a deep belonging and belovedness that our souls crave so deeply. Mm-hmm. And you're giving us a roadmap through all of your amazing work and lived experience. We just are so grateful for you sharing so vulnerably. What a gift to be with you today and to be with my amazing partner in crime, Leah Case. And just thank you so much, Amy Julia. We will no doubt talk to you again very, very soon. Thank you for joining us on the Good Hard Story podcast. To learn more about what we are doing, follow us on Instagram at Hope Heals. Check out all things Hope Heals at hopeheals.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this wherever you get podcasts, and please feel free to share this episode with somebody who needs to hear it. Good Hard Story Podcast is a production of Good Hard Story, LLC. It is produced and edited by Leah Case and Mary Austin Hall. And I am your fearless and fabulous host, Catherine Wolf. Come back and join us every week where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the very same story. with you and for you, friend.